Welcome to Victoria Rumble Room, an island show that likes to point its lens around to issues near and far. I'm Robin Adair, and joining me, as always, from his Saanich lair is the Croatian sensation himself, John Jurisic. And John, it seems we're talking a lot about the BC election season right now, and it's not just the BC election that people are talking about on Vancouver Island.
I tell you, election fever is starting to heat up, and we're not really in the meat of it yet. However, in BC, with big polling numbers, David Eby is looking at a big win next fall. But will he wait for the fall? Oh, it must be tempting. Some pundits and insiders are suggesting the NDP might want to pull the lever right now, when they're sky high in public opinion and the opposition center-right parties are splitting the vote. John Horgan called an election in the middle of a pandemic. That seemed to work out pretty good. So don't be shocked if Mr. Eby decides to drop the writ sooner than expected. Anything's possible in British Columbia.
And they say that over and over again around election time. And there is this other complicating factor. As I mentioned, it's not BC politics per se, although it is politics, it's in British Columbia. It is the rise of the Federal Conservative Party and its popularity across Western Canada, but on Vancouver Island in particular. The Tory surge is being felt in central and northern Vancouver Island in particular. And, you know, the BC Party, the BC Conservatives seem to be benefiting from some of this. Certainly the polls are suggesting they are. They have hooked their wagon to a winner as far as John Rustad is concerned. And you have to take Nanaimo as an example of the excitement that's building around this whole conservative movement. Pierre Poilievre, the national leader, in Nanaimo to a packed room. This is traditionally a stronghold region for the New Democrats, but blue-collar workers, working families, and a lot of young people responding to the Conservatives' promise to scrap the carbon tax, get tough on crime, get our resource-based economy back on its feet, along with the thousands of jobs that this all represents. In urban areas like Victoria and Vancouver, jury's still out about Pierre Poilievre, but what about small-town BC? We asked a Business Examiner columnist, Mark McDonald, about this growing strength by the Tories. And now joining us once again in the Victoria Rumble Room, the former owner and a columnist with the Business Examiner all the way from Nanaimo, Mark McDonald. Great to have you on the show.
Always great to see you guys again. Always great.
Well, there's always things to talk about. And we were hoping off the top to get your pulse of what's going on in central and northern Vancouver Island when it comes to the issues, particularly issues on political leanings. Let's face it, this has been, in British Columbia, a very interesting situation where we have a province that has been provincially very much in the pocket of the NDP, but a very different story federally, where we have the Conservatives certainly rising in the polls across the province. They seem to be doing very well in central and northern BC. Pierre Poilievre visiting Vancouver Island. In many cases, the people that turn out for this, I imagine, are average working people. What's the Tory message that's resonating?
Well, I think people realizing how expensive the Trudeau government is. I mean, you know, when you're going to, the food prices are going up, and Poilievre has done a good job of explaining why that is, because it takes, you know, gas to fuel the cars and the vehicles to deliver the food, to grow the food. And so one thing leads to another, and people are just realizing, wait a minute, this is way too expensive. And so he's really hitting the one note. And if you look at Poilievre, he's really resonating with younger people. So you mentioned earlier that Vancouver Island has kind of this rebellious voting history. We had reform on the island, which powered, you know, Canadian Alliance and then some of the conservative seats that we had. So there, that vote has existed, and I think that they've come back. But what is really interesting in the Poilievre's meetings is the younger people. I was floored with the amount of people that are pushing strollers, young families coming, because they realize, you know what, we're not able to get ahead anymore, and this has to change. So realistically, Polyev is really pulling from some of the far left are coming into his camp because they feel like he's resonating with them and speaking their language and speaking for them.
Mark, always a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks so much for coming back.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Want to dig deeper into your comment about Reform Party. You know, back in the 90s, back when I was, maybe 10 or 12 years old, Preston Manning and the Reform Party really took off in places like Nanaimo, Port Alberni, and Duncan, as you referenced. Just to name a few, the Reform Party talked about getting a new deal for Western Canadians. That really resonated. The motto was, "The West wants in." How is this conservative message different from reform, this current conservative message? How is it different from reform, and how is it the same?
Well, I think there always is the feeling that Canada is dominated by Quebec and Ontario. And again, if you look, I was looking again the other day about the seats, it doesn't really matter what the rest of Canada does if Quebec and Ontario vote a certain way. So the Harper government had tried to get more MPs in Western Canada, which would have made a difference. But anyway, it is what it is. And I think Poilievre's message is obviously based on the gas tax, but he's also highlighting the dictatorial ways of Trudeau. I mean, Pierre Trudeau gave the finger to Western Canada, and this guy's got two fingers out. And I've said this before. I said, it seems like the Trudeau government, their whole goal is to maintain power, which they know they can do if they control Ontario and Quebec. And who cares about the West? But Pierre Trudeau's national energy policy crippled Alberta in a day, and I think that Justin Trudeau has come to finish off the job. I think that he looks at Albertan wealth as a threat, and they don't want Western power. So I think as Poilievre keeps talking that language, the people basically, John, people don't feel they're being listened to or heard. Trudeau comes out here for vacations and then dumps tax money out in various programs and the housing situation, which never gets solved. All they do is announce. And we're bearing the brunt of his policies out here. And the younger families, this is what is interesting to me. Conservative conventions and gatherings were always filled with gray hairs, right? And now you're seeing younger people saying, "Who's speaking for me? Who's speaking for me?" And they feel that Poilievre has hit those notes.
So, amongst the things that Pierre Poilievre is talking about, is he referencing what's going on in BC politics and the BC Conservative Party? I haven't actually heard him say a lot about the BC Conservatives, but John Rustad certainly never misses an opportunity to talk about how they have similarities in some of their policies. So, do you believe yourself that this sudden rise of John Rustad and the BC Conservatives can be directly attributed to what's going on with Pierre Poilievre and the federal team?
100%. 100%, Robin. I mean, ask people on the street, who is John Rustad? What does he even look like? And he's got the same problem as Falcon. And I told Falcon face to face, I said, "Hey, you're invisible." Well, they're both kind of invisible. If you put a picture up of John Rustad on the screen, I don't think people would know who he is. This is all about the federal conservative message that people are resonating with.
In many ways, the BC NDP is campaigning as much against Pierre Poilievre as they are against Kevin Falcon's BC United or John Rustad's BC Conservatives, also holding on to their 10% sort of standard 10% support of the Green Party. And they also look vulnerable right now. Fascinating stuff. Love
And
it.
speaking of fascinating, let's not forget what's going on in Victoria right now. A Victoria Council and awarding themselves a 23% pay increase, making full-time salaries out of what were supposed to be part-time jobs. And it's interesting how they sort of ram this through when at least one councillor wasn't even there to vote.
Our good friend, Councillor Chris Coleman, good friend because I've known him from since UVic days, who was in Sri Lanka working on an outreach assignment for the Canadian government. All of a sudden, his phone starts ringing crazy with messages telling him, This vote has occurred without him, basically behind his back. Very disrespectful behavior. Mayor Alto wasn't pleased and wouldn't vote for the raise under these or potentially any circumstances.
You know, former Victoria councillor Stephen Andrews says that the councillors who voted in favor of this knew full well what the job entailed, what the hours were like, and in his estimation, this was a pay grab, was long planned and carefully executed. And Stephen now has a petition that's been out for a couple of weeks demanding the reversal on this raise. You know, I still believe there's not much chance of that happening, but we want to hear more from Stephen Andrews, so here he is.
Stephen, so great to have you back on the Rumble Room, okay?
Thanks.
We've missed you. I was very disappointed when I saw council do this. I personally have 40 plus years of business involvement, ownership, and advocacy. I have been involved with dozens of compensation and pay-related scenarios. Never, ever, ever would I have been involved with such a botched process as has just happened in Victoria. There should have been open, transparent, effective comparative analysis and ongoing inclusive communication times 10. I also thought it was pretty cheap that they didn't wait for veteran counselor Chris Coleman to come back from a holiday before pulling the lever. So this petition, do you imagine, do you think it will still be remembered in 2 years when we finally get to a civic election in 2026? That's a long ways away.
Yeah, well, I would say, John, yes, it will, because I'm going to make sure it is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring it up. The thing with this petition, I think people, it's not just, you know, at putting any fake name down. All of the signatures on this petition are verified. They have to provide a verifiable email address, and they put their real name in. And if you go into the petition, I'll tell you, and I'll put a link on my website, stephenandrew.ca, so that people can find it very quickly. They can read all the comments, and they're very much the same, that people are just very, very angry that they've done this. The other issue that Cardona brought up and they've been bringing up is that they didn't realize how much time it took. Well, when the election campaign was on in 2022, I got a number of council candidates at that time asked to meet with me. And I met with Cardona, I met with Matt Dell, and I met with Dave Thompson. And I explained to them, because they said to me, you know, what's a typical week like? And I took them through the process. I took them through the number of hours. I explained to them what was going on. So they knew how much time it was going to take when they jumped in.
Let's have a little fun here, hypothetical, around a report card for this council. Aside from the pay raise, which in my humble opinion warrants an F, how are they doing in your estimation? Have they made some good moves? What would your report card look like if you were to grade them today?
Generally, I think that they're setting around a C, C minus most of the time. I think that they're not doing the job which they were elected to do, and that is govern the city. What they're trying to do is run the city, and Cardona says they've met about 90% of the recommendations at the MMP report that came through. I disagree with that. I mean, I think they've cherry-picked and they've neutered many of the recommendations. We're still in the same situation. I feel like we're in quicksand. We're just not moving forward. And we can do all kinds of things like fix the Centennial Square. We can, you know, buy a new building for the Jazz. You know, these are small little virtue signaling projects that are not really bringing things to the table.
It's just so interesting to see the way that these political controversies are overlapping with each other, from Ottawa to the legislature to the city hall. A case in point is housing. New laws set to ban short-term holiday rentals, very controversial, have owners spinning and facing significant losses of investment.
And in a city like Victoria, it's really being felt. You know, they have the ongoing tourism market coming in, looking for hotel space. And for example, the Janion building, It has up until now served as a place where people could get quick rentals and they could stay for a few days or even a few weeks. It was basically an extension of hotel room properties. And Victoria needs more hotel accommodation. In Parksville, they want a reprieve, and maybe this will have a ripple effect. For more on this housing situation and the role of government, the pro and con, let's zoom in Casey Edge from the Victoria Residential Builders Association.
Now joining us, a regular and very popular guest in the Rumble Room, Casey Edge. Great to have you here, and there's so much to talk about. Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there is. There's been a lot of changes.
So that was a great lead-in, John. That was a great lead-in.
Thank you. Well, let's start right out of the gate with lots of promises of new housing and construction. Billions on the table from Ottawa and Victoria. What do you, Casey, make of the Homes for People and BC Builds initiatives laid out in the BC budget? And how is the new law on house flipping being received?
Yeah, well, these are mostly distractions to appeal to the voters, to show that the government is stepping up and pouring billions of dollars into a problem that they created. So that's basically it. I mean, at the end of the day, we built sufficient housing decades ago. So today, there is one new home for every 4.2 Canadians entering the workforce. The historical average is one new home for every 1.8 people. So the issue really is that we used to build sufficient housing for our population. We no longer do that. And the reason for that is government. So government discovered housing is a cash machine. So GST, so decades of 1970s, no GST, no property transfer tax. They piled on PST, DCCs, community amenity contributions. So they're taking billions out of the housing industry. And that doesn't even include the zoning obstructions that take place at the municipal level.
Casey, I'm interested to hear what you think about what the federal government's up to with this massive immigration that's coming to the country. There have been suggestions we need to slow it down a bit. And yet anybody who makes those suggestions gets scolded by federal ministers. There's implications that somehow this is racism. No one's saying we shouldn't bring people in from around the world, especially people who have wonderful gifts that they can bring to Canada, great skills, great contributions. But there is suggestions that even the new people that are arriving have nowhere to live, let alone people that are already here. What's your view on the whole immigration question and how it sort of permeates into the housing question?
Well, I think everybody can agree that Canadians are not replacing themselves. That's true. That's statistically true. And so we do need immigration for the economy to replace our population. The challenge is you have a federal government responsible for immigration, having no authority over municipalities responsible for approving housing. So there's this massive disconnect between policies at the federal, provincial, and municipal levels. So you have then exactly what you've got right now, inadequate housing for the immigration numbers. How do you fix that? You don't implement federal policy without having downstream policies that will accommodate what you're trying to achieve.
All right, I'm going to drag you into the political ecosystem here. Casey, while the province lays out its pre-election housing strategy, Kevin Falcon and BC United are pitching their own housing plan to get first-time buyers into homes. This includes dropping the property transfer tax, eliminating PST on new homes, building on empty public land, and establishing a rent-to-own program. Boy, that all sounds pretty cool. Are these ideas the current government might consider borrowing themselves?
Well, reducing the property transfer tax is an important step. But if you compare our property transfer tax to Alberta, it's not even in the same universe. So we pay an average of $16,000 property transfer tax for an average priced home in British Columbia. In Alberta, they pay about $400. It's a fee for service. So when you say, so when parties say, well, we're going to tinker with the property transfer tax, never mind the tinkering. You're making over $2 billion a year from the property transfer tax. And that's because the property transfer tax is paid through multiple development of one new home. So you have the landowner selling the property to the developer, and the developer pays property transfer tax. You have the development subdivided into lots. A builder buys a lot, and you pay property transfer tax to the BC government a second time. The builder builds a new home, and consumer buys it. You have property transfer tax paid a third time. So you have up to two property transfer taxes already embedded in that home. And that's how they make over $2 billion. So when political parties say, well, we're going to tinker with the property transfer tax, and even this government says, well, there's a property transfer tax exemption for new home buyers. Well, they don't mention that there's already up to two property transfer taxes already embedded in the price of that home that they're getting money for. So, yeah.
How about rent to own? Do you like that idea?
All of these government programs are unnecessary if the government would get the heck out of the way when it comes to construction. If you read Evan Mast's study, he talks about how housing is an ecosystem, and that more affordable housing is created, and even rental is even created, if you allow the industry to build. And he did a study of a dozen cities showing how government programs, regulations, fees interfere with this housing ecosystem. Even if you build luxury homes, somebody from the middle class moves up into, say, the luxury home. And that frees up a lower income home, and that frees up a rental. And there's this ecosystem. And we built plenty of housing back in the 70s. So what's the difference between the 70s and today? The difference is government regulations and fees.
But didn't the government just take big steps to fast forward and move through municipal regulations to get places built faster? Don't we see all sorts of construction projects being approved right and left? We just had a new 269-unit, 23-story rental building that was approved for the Village Green area. There won't be any cars, but that's okay because Marianne Alto says she'd rather support homes for people than homes for cars. But still, is it not true the government, the provincial government, is really at least making a lot of promises about getting out of the way and letting people build?
The government has created these targets for a number of municipalities saying you must build these many homes. Because municipalities like Oak Bay, even though they had, say, 25 housing starts, those weren't mostly new homes. Those were replacement homes. So they weren't adding to the new housing stock. So yes, the government, and by through these rezonings, that's a step forward. But keep in mind that this is all a workaround. The workaround is they don't want to amalgamate the municipalities. So they're going to do a workaround, which is establishing these housing targets and these rezonings. There are going to be challenges with this. One of them is going to be that they also expanded development cost charges. They also legalized community amenity contributions. So they've actually increased the cost of development with these rezonings. We're going to see how all of this plays out. In addition, now the CRD wants to charge up to $9,000 per new home for an upstream water filtration plant. This idea, it's one thing to say, okay, we need a new sewer or expanded water system in a neighborhood where some new housing is going. It's another thing to be talking about adding $9,000 per home in a housing affordability crisis for an upstream billion-dollar project that the community that where the new housing is already going to pay you get you're getting expanded property taxes from anyway, and that project should be paid for by senior levels of government through the income tax income taxes by the federal and provincial governments, and so this business of again this really speaks to what I was saying before how they offload all of their costs onto new housing, which is why we don't have the housing supply, which is why the government's bringing in these new programs to say we're going to improve something that we completely screwed up. Now, you won't hear the second half of that sentence out of their mouths, but you'll talk about faster. When has the government delivered anything faster? I mean, it's just, and who's going to build these? You mean the under-supplied construction companies that are already needing skilled trades? The government doesn't build anything. They hire the private sector to build. Their system right now through their RFP system, many of my builders won't participate in that because of the bureaucracy involved. So we're going to see how much this translate into new housing. But as I said, save the taxpayers billions of dollars and just get out of the way. Municipal, provincial, federal governments, get out of the way. Let us build the way we built without all the regulations and fees in the 70s, and there'll be plenty of new housing for all income levels.
All right, I'm going to end up our conversation here with asking you something akin to the meaning of life. So they're not going to get out of the way. How does this fix itself? Like, does some kind of on-the-ground revolution? Or, I completely agree with everything you've... I've been in the business. I don't see anything changing dramatically, Casey. What is going to have to happen for more housing, for some of the suggestions you've made to actually happen?
Well, some of our suggestions, actually, what we've been advocating for, there have actually been some changes in the government. So as an example, we talked about the immigration issue and you know, the disconnect from housing years ago. Stats Can came up with this information back in 2019. We were writing columns on it. We have said for a long time, this is a supply issue, and this is why it's a supply issue. Now, if you think back to half a dozen years ago, the government was claiming this was a demand issue, that it wasn't, and that taxation was going to fix the problem. So speculation tax, foreign buyers tax, school tax, all of these taxes were going to fix the housing affordability problem and reduce demand by reducing demand. Well, what happened was the media, like yourselves, said, well, okay, except that's what you said, and now housing prices are continuing to rise. So it's not working. And we were at the same time saying, this is all junk. This is all nonsense. It's all politics. And we have a supply problem. Now, what did the government do over the past couple of years? We have a supply problem. We're going to create programs. We're going to do all these things to boost supply. They are in denial until they can't be in denial anymore. And that's basically through surveys that they do, education of the voters, the media start to understand better. And then they realize they can't sell that bill of goods anymore to the voters. And then they start shifting. And that's because at the end of the day, it's all about the money. They don't want to give up the money. They'd rather have more taxation. The flipping taxes, and how many taxes have we got for vacant homes and flipping and all the rest, federal, provincial, municipal? We've got multiple vacancy taxes, anti-flipping taxes, all the rest of it. And frankly, it's all junk. And what it is, it's a red herring. It's a distraction to distract the voters and the media from the real issues, which is government has screwed up the housing market, and now they, as you point out, John, it's got to get fixed, and it's got to get fixed through promoting the private sector, the market, to provide the housing. And that's going to be the solution. How that gets done, we'll have to see.
Hey, another action-packed Rumble Room, Johnny. And it's always great to be able to bring these issues to the forefront. And we want to thank, again, our many viewers for joining us on a weekly basis and supporting our show. And if you'd like more information on how you can regularly watch the Rumble Room, subscribe and become part of the Rumble Room family, John, I know you'd love to share that information.
My favorite part of the show. No, the whole thing is so very grateful to the close to now 1.7, likely over, million cumulative views of folks who've watched our show since we got this project going about 2.5 years ago. So many ways that you can watch us. Of course, we're supporting our YouTube inventory. Here are the links to YouTube. Think about subscribing. Think about liking. We're also on Facebook. We're on X. We are on audio podcasting. We're on Instagram, and we're on TikTok, TikTok. So we're everywhere. Again, I'm John Jurisic with a big announcement, Robin. Very big announcement. I'm officially announcing a 23% increase on my current salary doing this show. So I'm going from zero to zero. However, it's 23% and still free of charge.
It's fantastic. We keep giving ourselves huge raises based on our percentage of zero. And it's amazing how good we feel about that, Johnny.
Don't we?
It's part of the bedrock of a free society. I'm Robin Adair, and you can think about that as you rumble on.